Department is the most dreaded branch of the police. They're the ones tasked with investigating crimes of a political nature. The ones who might cart you and your family away in the middle of the night without advance warning. For all we know, he could be. For all we know, he could also be someone's private security. There are rich people everywhere. "Do you know how much it costs to get in here?" Alexander asks. "I don't. But I know it's pocket change for us, and several times the official monthly salary for average North Koreans. And the park is jam-packed. Some would have been given admission tickets from their work units as rewards. But certainly not all. Earlier, waiting in line to take our turn on a water slide, we were bypassed by a family accompanied by a lifeguard. Obviously, they had paid extra for VIP service, so as to avoid the pain of standing in line all day with the proles. That morning in the van on the way to Mansu Hill, Alec had asked for permission to post photos and videos of me on the website he is developing for Tongil Tours. It would be key, publicity-wise, in attracting more numbers for next year's tour, he said. I had consented, unthinkingly. "Are you sure you want to do that?" Alexander asks me, now that Alec is out of earshot. I reply that I honestly hadn't given it much thought. Alexander's eyes dart about. He obviously has something on his mind, but the sauna is packed with people. Who knows who's listening in? With a nod, we mutually agree to find a safer area to continue our conversation. We walk outside to one of the wading pools. The roar of an artificial waterfall drowns out our voices. "I told Alec that I didn't want my face to appear in any of the photos," Alexander says. "I've been to this country now many times, and under different contexts. But I'm a discreet guy, and I don't want to give the wrong impression." "What do you mean? Give who the wrong impression?" Alexander's eyes go back and forth again, making sure no one is near. "That I'm endorsing any of this. I mean, I don't like the regime," he says. He does have reason for concern. There are foreigners who are apologists of the DPRK system. On my first trip to Pyongyang in 2012, I spotted a stout Spaniard sitting two rows in front of me on the plane, frothing at the mouth as he pointed to a picture of Kim Jong-il in the Pyongyang Times, and raving to the poor sob seated next to him. A feeling of dread and fear welled up in my stomach. I recognized him from Friends of Kim, a 2006 documentary about a tour of North Korea organized by the Korean Friendship Association, KFA, a pro-DPRK outfit that claims to have members around the world. This was Alejandro Caudebenos de Les y Perez, the chairman of KFA. Over the years, Alejandro has presented himself as the official Western spokesman of the DPRK government, wildly exaggerating claims of his ties to the country, even boasting of titles that the government never actually bestowed upon him, as a means of luring foreign guests on trips he organizes to the DPRK. Among Alejandro's boasts, he has said he has been conferred honorary citizenship and a DPRK passport. "Impossible," scoffed my Korean guide when I asked her about it on my first trip to the country in 2012. Nevertheless, gullible tourists who are unaware of his exaggerations and outright lies are often persuaded in the mistaken belief that this is the only way one may visit North Korea, or that KFA will be able to provide them with special access to sites that ordinary tourists are unable to visit. In Friends of Kim, this special access amounts to a pro-DPRK propaganda parade that his group members are forced to march in beneath the reunification monument on Tongil Street. Most disturbing about the documentary, however, are the myriad displays of behavior that could perhaps best be described as sociopathic. More zealous in his devotion to the regime's politics than even the most fervent North Korean propagandist, Alejandro goes so far as to break into the hotel room of a journalist on the trip, to destroy his camera and laptop in the paranoid belief that he might be preparing to report unsympathetic views of the DPRK in his subsequent dispatch, much to the embarrassment of the North Korean guides on the trip. Other delegates on KFA trips have reported that whenever anyone challenges him or otherwise ignites his very short fuse, Alejandro has threatened to have them deported or else report them to his contacts in the state security apparatus. Despite his boasts of insiderdom, I've never met a North Korean who actually likes Alejandro or shows much appreciation for the work he does on behalf of their country. The DPRK's political system is, after all, an ethnically closed system in its ideology, not intended for foreign consumption. This is why foreign tourists need not worry about being brainwashed or converted. Any North Korean will tell you that their political system is designed by Koreans and for Koreans only. Surprisingly, this seems to have eluded Alejandro, as he constantly speaks about the country in the first person plural, as though he himself were a part of the Korean masses. Something that clearly aggravates actual DPR Koreans, who, owing to the traumas of their colonial past, are militantly against the idea of any outside force speaking on their behalf. On a more profound level, when they see these propaganda antics being parroted by an outsider, it must make them realize how ridiculous and fanatical their entire system looks. Behind Alexander's fear of being used for propaganda purposes, does his refusal belie his trust in Alec? Now that I think of it, Alec has a tendency to withdraw when, in our whispered conversations, Alexander and I become either too critical of the politics of the DPRK or too gossipy in our speculations on the private lives or beliefs of our hosts. A professional distance, I suppose. Certainly Alec is no Alejandro. He is in the difficult position of playing a dual role, as both organizer of the trip and student participant, which makes him both one of us and, in a sense, not. All Western tour operators to the DPRK find themselves in a similar predicament. They are, after all, peddling a product that many find indefensible. Like Koryo tours, Alec and Tongil tours emphasize the importance of person-to-person engagement over the negative repercussions of isolation that international diplomacy overwhelmingly imposes on the country. Such policies, he argues, only adversely affect the North Korean people, who already suffer enough owing to the policies of their government. In conversation, Alec can become quite passionate in his advocacy of the need for what he calls a nuanced understanding of North Korea. Neither Alexander nor I would deny that Alec is right on this point. But there are moments when his passion seems to lead him toward an empathetic identification with our hosts, revealing what I can only describe as a willful naivete. And naivete, whether willed or not, can be dangerous. There are limits to every kind of engagement. But there is something more going on between Alec and Alexander, an exchange of knowing glances here, a whispered conversation there. Now that Alexander and I are alone beneath the waterfall, I ask him if I'm missing out on something. His face turns sheepish. Okay, I'm sorry. I wanted to tell you this earlier, but I didn't want the guides to hear, even though they probably know. I'm sure they are given a file before we come, where they can see everything, but still. Alexander trails off. So what is it? What's up? 2 years ago, my university did an exchange program. It was highly unofficial. It was not announced anywhere. France is participating in the sanctions, so if word ever got out, it would have caused a huge scandal. But anyway, it happened. Some North Korean students came to my university in France, and I was one of 10 students who came here to study at Kim Il-sung University. I'm stunned. I had never heard of any foreigners studying here before us. I thought we were the first. I ask him how long he was here. It was just 1 month, he says, like us on this trip. But the difference is I was on a student visa. I got to live in the dorms, and because I wasn't on a tourist visa, I didn't have guides. I could walk around anywhere I wanted to go. One day, I just decided to go for a walk, and I traipsed through the entire city for 5 hours. Did anyone try to stop you? I ask, incredulous and a little envious. No, they could have. Lots of people were looking at me funny, but no one did. They didn't say a word. So now, you can imagine why this trip is so hard for me, having to be accompanied by them everywhere we go. When I was here before, I could go almost anywhere alone. But for now, doing this program with Alec is the only way I could find to come back. And you haven't told Min yet? No. But surely they must know. It's not something you can really keep secret around here. Maybe, says Alexander. He looks down shyly. But for the moment, I just want to be a bit discreet. It seems strange. And again, everything is a bit strange here. Not just the place, but the people. And not just the local people, but the tourists who willingly choose to come here. And especially, it follows, the ones like us. The moths who keep flocking back to the flame, overtaken by the mystery. Back at the hotel that night, odd thoughts cloud my thinking. Alexander's insistence on discretion, his unwillingness to be completely open with our guides. It makes me wonder whether he has an overarching agenda in being here that he doesn't want anyone, including Alec and me, to know. Is he really here independently? An international man of mystery? Maybe I'm being paranoid. For this place, it's not unusual to drift into that thought sphere. It's something you easily get locked into, that you begin to notice, even in places as benign as the water park. An undercurrent of paranoia is woven into the fabric of daily life. I notice it, but wonder if the Koreans are aware of it as well, or if they have grown completely immune to it. When I was in Havana last year, the artist Tanya Bruguera told me that Cubans currently live under a condition she deems Fear 2.0, where you have two or three generations who are simply born with fear already encoded in their DNA. More recently, in her book, The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia, Masha Gessen tracks the multi-generational evolution of a similar process of fear encoding that continues to afflict the mass psychology of denizens of the former Soviet Union and their descendants. Paranoia comes to form the natural order of things. It comes encased in the subtlest of details, which you become adept at reading, such as that everyday occurrence, felt most strongly at the water park, where everyone was staring at us, but no one wanted to engage for fear of the possible repercussions. No foreigner, after all, is to be trusted. Even Min, who on the surface seems more cosmopolitan and open given her life experience. Even Min has her limits. Min, child of intrigue. If it's true that North Koreans often come across as enigmatic figures to foreigners who encounter them, then it is also true that this is usually intentional, and for a complex set of reasons. Cultural differences. In North Korea, there's a general distrust of fellow human beings, a natural consequence of living in what is probably the most heavily monitored society the world has yet known, where anyone is a potential snitch. Everyone has at least one experience of betrayal to provide a fine coating of distrust. When you cannot fully trust your neighbors or extended family, you are not likely to confide very much in a foreigner, especially when you have been taught your entire life that all foreigners are potentially enemy agents. What you are born into defines who you are. Who you are will define what you are able to do. In the Songbun system, instituted by Kim Il-sung around the time he was conducting those purges against his enemies in the Politburo, your born essence is inescapable. Save for the very few whose position of high privilege is determined by the helpful things their grandparents or great-grandparents did in Kim Il-sung's glory days, there is no direction to travel in besides straight ahead or else way down. Upward mobility is a possibility for an extremely small minority. With it comes tremendous risks. Min clearly belongs to some Pyongyang minority of privilege, though it is hard to determine which. There are many gradations within the three categories of loyal, wavering, and hostile classes. But her parents were at least trusted enough to be selected to go and live in Cuba for 8 years, where her mother worked as chef for the DPRK embassy, and her father did business. And that is essentially the world Min was reared in. From the age of 10 to 18, she went to Cuban schools, spoke Spanish fluently, learned to dance salsa and mambo. Cuba ostensibly operates under a similar socialist system to the DPRK. In actuality, it is much more open. Unlike the DPRK, Cuba does not forbid its citizens from watching or listening to foreign media. Min grew up listening to Green Day, System of a Down, Madonna, Britney Spears, watching Harry Potter movies, without fear of being punished. She's been back in Pyongyang now for nearly 8 years, but still slips up, lets her guard down constantly when she's around us. Says things without any fear of consequences. She tells us that she wishes she had stayed behind in Havana to finish her university studies, and then bites her tongue. She sings Barbie Girl at karaoke. She tells us that one of her colleagues at work was recently reprimanded for constantly playing World of Warcraft on the clock. Recklessness, or naivete? Both, perhaps. Part of it is that Min feels protected enough by who she is, who her family is. But it's also that Min is, in a sense, a creature from another world. A creature of circumstance. Not the born revolutionary. Yearning to be more than merely someone's daughter. But what? She wears the badge, she talks the talk, but this is not her natural habitat. She's trying her best to wade through the waters. She is still trying to figure out, after all this time, what it means to be Korean. What it means to be disciplined. What it means to obey. I take the elevator down to the lobby to see if Mark still wants to have that drink. Tonight he's seated at a table with a tense-looking crowd. Simon and the Korean colleagues, all in Mao suits and chain-smoking, trapped in some bureaucratic stalemate. Mark gives an awkward wave and then shrugs his shoulders. The scene doesn't look very inviting, so I head back to my room. It probably wouldn't be good to start tomorrow with a hangover anyway. I'm getting ready for bed when a knock sounds on my door. I open it to find Alexander standing there in his underwear. Sorry, Travis. Can I come in for a minute? Seeing that I'm also a bit underdressed, we both laugh awkwardly. It doesn't really matter. There aren't any other guests staying on the floor. I just wanted to tell you, he whispers. Alec and I decided that tomorrow we would all dress nice for the first day of class. You know, to make a good impression. I smile. For Alexander, it's all about first impressions. The Korean songs at karaoke, visiting the Mansu Hill to leave flowers. But I've caught up with him. My pressed shirt and new trousers are already laid out for the first day of school. Part 3. Norco Realism. Chapter 9. Our cherubic driver, Wa, can't be a day over 25, though no one's bothered to ask. He's just gotten out of the military, so he's probably a bit older, since most men are conscripted for 10 years in the DPRK. He also worked as a driver for his military service. For someone of lower middle Songbun, it's considered a specialized job. Until recently, very few were entitled to the use of vehicles. Even fewer knew how to drive them. At the very least, it's a job that relieves one of having to engage in back-breaking manual labor, though Wa's dark tan indicates the frequency with which he is called away when there is no delegation to shuttle about. When he's with us, he's always smiling and fully present. Unlike other drivers I've had, who tend to play a more servile role, always waiting behind in the parking lot whenever we're driven to a new site, Wa accompanies us and takes a keen interest in whatever activity we're engaged in, whether it's a visit to an aquarium or a museum. Alexander says it's because we're mainly going to places that tourists don't normally go, and so they are places that Wa also hasn't seen. I think it's more likely that he hasn't had the opportunity to see much of anything before. Since it's considered a somewhat vaunted profession in the DPRK, drivers, whether they be truckers or chauffeurs, take their jobs seriously. Each morning, Wah pulls up in front of the hotel entrance, and the van is spotlessly clean inside and out, no matter the duration of the previous day's road trip and the state we left the vehicle in the night before. Alexander tells me that he got up early one morning for a walk on the hotel grounds and watched as Wah diligently removed each of the tires from the van and gave them a rigorous inspection, making sure everything was in perfect running order. Our route takes us the same way every morning, from west to east through the heart of Pyongyang, providing us with a moving panorama of the morning city as it readies itself for the day. Past the scenic Potong River, with the leafy branches of its overgrown willow trees dipping into the placid waters, and the Potonggang Hotel, considered one of Pyongyang's swankier digs. Among other amenities, it has the best Japanese restaurant in town, and even CNN in all the rooms. We wind our way through the Changwang district of central Pyongyang, with its white, dome-shaped ice skating rink, a retro-futuristic relic that wouldn't look out of place among the space-age-style buildings scattered around the Eastern Bloc in the 1970s. Past a wide, empty street, blocked off with a mobile metal gate and a guard, a forest of trees obscures the views of the buildings. Though you won't find this area marked on any official map, this is where members of the Central Committee live and work. Satellite images show a green park with palatial villas fringed by smaller guardhouses. Where trees and hills don't suffice, a row of apartment blocks, likely the dwelling places of slightly lower-ranking cadres, obscures the view. Though no one would ever say so out loud, this is also the likely central Pyongyang office of the number one man in the country. Cars everywhere. It's morning rush hour for sure, though never enough traffic to warrant a jam. The vast majority of vehicles these days are taxis. The sheer quantity reveals the burgeoning wealth of the city. In the mornings, they are crammed with people sharing the ride, making for a comfier alternative to Pyongyang's overcrowded buses and trams, where pickpocketing is said to be rampant. We cross the Taedong River into East Pyongyang. There, on the banks, we are greeted with the glass-windowed facade of the large Ryugyong Health and Recreational Complex, which kind of resembles a middle American corporate office park. It's a series of buildings that includes the Golden Lanes Bowling Alley, a hamburger fast food joint, an upscale espresso bar popular among expats, indoor and outdoor skating rinks. More recently, a large sauna complex has been opened for the Donju. It boasts ground-floor shops selling foreign luxury clothing brands, a gym, an indoor swimming pool, and men's and women's saunas crowned with an expensive restaurant and bar. The first time I visited, on my way upstairs to the restaurant, I was greeted with an unusual large framed photograph. In the middle of the frame, what appeared to my eyes was a stout, butch lesbian wearing an ugly apron and sullen frown, dangling a dead fish over a frying pan. It took a long squint for me to decipher that it was actually a young Kim Jong-il, with his glasses removed, demonstrating his culinary genius. So unlike the standard propaganda portraits you see of smiling Kim Jong-il everywhere else you look in North Korea, you have to wonder what they had in mind by installing it here. Again, I saw proof that they're aware of the inherent vulnerability of such images. As I raised my phone to take a photo, a guard who had been seated at a desk partially hidden behind a wall in the hallway emerged and ordered me to stop. As we get deeper into the east part of town, away from all the monuments and the beating heart of the Workers' Party, another Pyongyang reveals itself. The apartment buildings grow increasingly run down, and as we traverse the depths of the Tongdaewon district, it becomes clear we're in the poor part of town. Tourists are rarely taken farther east beyond the Jucha Tower and the recreational facilities of the Ryugyong complex, both of which sit on the eastern banks of the Taedong. Though there is a part of the east where Comrade Kim lives that is up and coming, gentrifying if such a concept existed here, most of it remains quite poor. This and the neighboring Songyo district were among the only parts of Pyongyang that were actually afflicted by the famine of the 1990s, where some residents starved to death. This is the part of town where Hwa lives. As we approach Kim Hyong-jik University of Education, apartment buildings give way to single-story shack-like houses, reminiscent of the colonial period, surrounded by dirt roads. The university is itself on one of the main avenues, however, its front entrance kept in pristine condition, as one would expect of a school named after Kim Il-sung's father. The gated entrance is manned by a security guard who checks the documents of all who enter. On the stone scaffolding above this entrance, a brass-embossed calligraphied stencil, a facsimile of Kim Il-sung's handwriting, has been installed, preserving yet another profundity for all eternity. Alec translates for me. Kim Hyong-jik University is a good university. Pedagogy is the main subject. Future teachers from around the country learn their trade here. Then there is the small Korean for Foreigners program in the linguistics department, where international exchange students, predominantly Chinese, can complete BA and MA degrees in the language of Joseon. The linguistics department is housed in one of the front buildings facing Sasilim Street, before which stretches a soccer field that won't see any use while we're here. School's not in session in the summer months, and anyway, it's too hot to play. The only students around are a handful of Koreans enrolled in remedial classes. Each university has its own uniform. At Kim Hyong-jik, it's blue blazers and red ties. Long skirts for the girls and slacks for the guys, with the men also given bulky hats that look like a cross between those worn by Navy captains and the traditional communist worker's cap. Whenever a North Korean student passes a professor in the hallway, they are obliged to stop and give them a deep, respectful bow. A gesture of courtesy, Alec tells us, is also practiced in South Korea, and one that we quickly learn to adapt. We walk past the obligatory painting of Kim Jong-il in the entrance corridor, down the unlit hallways to the staircase, and then up to the third floor. We are led into the linguistics department's office, where, like in most offices in North Korea, there is a complete absence of computers or any other electronic equipment, making it reminiscent of an office from an earlier century. The administrator, a kindly, middle-aged woman with a bad perm, introduces us to our three teachers. We smile and make polite bows. It is all very formal and solemn, though with an underlying giddiness on the part of our teachers, who have never taught Western foreigners before. Mine, Ms. Park, is in her late 30s, only 2 years older than me, it turns out. She has a much better perm than her colleague in administration. It's a popular choice among North Korean women of a certain age, though it is growing less fashionable with the underground importation of the latest looks from Seoul. She flashes me a toothy grin and a shy glance from behind her gold-rimmed glasses before leading me down the hallway to our classroom, where I will have my choice of the dozen-some wooden desks each day as the only student in the beginner-level class. Chapter 10. One of the consequences of Korea's 70-year-plus division has been the evolution of distinctions between the ways Korean is spoken on either side of the 38th parallel. Accents vary throughout the peninsula, but North Koreans in general stand out for speaking in a way that often comes across as rural, prolish, rough, and low-bred to Southerners, especially in Seoul. North Koreans seem to implicitly agree. As South Korean television dramas and films began to spread on the black market, young North Koreans could suddenly be heard imitating the posh accents of their brethren in the South. At the same time, the Korean spoken in Joseon tends to be much more stiff, with the formal polite style, a style in the South that is usually only deployed in the military or when addressing a large crowd, being the favored mode of address in everyday life. This endows the North Korean version of the language with a quaint, charming sound to South Korean ears, as though the entire country were a small village undisturbed by time, as one writer put it. This formality is undercut with frequent eruptions of the profane, however. Even in official propaganda, When speaking of politicians from enemy nations like South Korea or the United States, it is not uncommon for newscasters or print media to refer to them as bastards, bitches, and whores. Or worse. In one editorial, President Obama was said to resemble a monkey in an African jungle. English-speaking students who wish to learn Korean in the South benefit from the frequent adaptation of words from their mother tongue. In their push for ethnic purity, North Koreans have attempted to keep their language pure. As a result, they have different words for many everyday things, which tends to cause some confusion when North Korean defectors arrive in the South. Learning a new language typically begins with the task of basic pronunciation. In the case of Korean, this coincides with the learning of the Korean alphabet. Hangul, as it is known in the South, Chosungul in the North. Prior to its invention by King Sejong, Korean was written using complex Chinese characters. As a result, most Koreans were effectively illiterate. When Sejong introduced his script in 1443, he asserted that a clever person could master it in 1 hour, an idiot in 10 days. I'm about to find out where I fall on the King's IQ test. Unlike Chinese, with its complex pictographic system consisting of thousands of strokes that must be memorized, as they do not correspond to sounds, Korean's series of horizontal and vertical sticks and circles forming a total of 28 letters, 17 consonants, and 11 vowels, is completely phonetic. The King's conception was equal parts cosmological, phonological, and anatomical. The vowels are meant as configurations of three primary sounds that represent the three primal elements of the universe: sky, earth, and human. While the form of each consonant resembles the shape of the mouth and or tongue as it pronounces the letter. As such, what Sejong accomplished is nothing less than a writing of the corporeal, an alignment of the body with the earth and the cosmos. Chosungul's graceful phoneticism culminates in the stacking of these letter sounds atop one another in order of pronunciation to form syllables. As daunting as it appears to foreigners and the otherwise illiterate, the systematic ingenuity of Chosungul is that within hours of mastering each letter's pronunciation, you can theoretically read any Korean text aloud without even understanding its meaning. My first task, then, is to learn this alphabet and its corresponding sounds, starting with the vowels. Which sounds easy enough? Were this Spanish or Italian, it could be accomplished in less than 5 minutes. But Korean's vowels, in part because there are so many of them, pose an immediate challenge to non-native speakers. For one thing, the differences between many of the sounds are subtle to American or European ears, though quite distinct to Koreans. What's more, many of these vowel sounds are actually diphthongs, vowel chains pronounced in rapid-fire succession. At the same time, this is made somewhat easier by the way Chosungul is written, with the letter meant to illustrate the position of the lips or the tongue when it is being pronounced, which Ms. Park demonstrates by pointing to her mouth and the letter as it is written on the whiteboard. My first day gives me a glance into the real North Korea that foreign journalists are always bemoaning they never get to see. There's no electricity in any of the public areas. Surprisingly, even the mural of Kim Jong-il at the entrance is shrouded in darkness. My classroom has electricity, but it's patchy, to say the least. Besides the whiteboard, above which the requisite portraits of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il smile down at the students, Ms. Park's other main teaching apparatus is a flat-screen television, upon which she will flash words and bits of the alphabet that she points at for me to repeat. In the middle of the first lesson, the power goes off. Without missing a beat, Ms. Park goes to the whiteboard and commences writing the lost vowels. The task proves difficult enough to warrant the entire first day's lesson spent on reading and repeating each vowel sound. At the end of class, Ms. Park suggests I make a video of her repeating the vowels on my phone so that I can practice pronunciation as part of tonight's homework. I'm no cinematographer, but I manage to arrange the shots so that I capture both the written letters as I've penned them in my notebook, and Ms. Pak's face as she points to each inscription and pronounces it. At the end, there is some agreement between Ms. Pak and me that I have gotten it halfway right. Or at least right enough so that tomorrow I can look forward to the next daunting task. Consonants. After class, I meet Comrade Kim, who's shown up unexpectedly, pacing the dark hallway. "Well, how was it?" he asks anxiously. I dutifully ejaculate the 11 vowel sounds I've learned. Comrade Kim claps his hands and repeats them with me before erupting in laughter. "You are very lucky," he says, suddenly turning serious. "When I was arranging the course, the administrator from the department told me that Ms. Pak is the best teacher for beginners in Korea. She has 15 years experience." I nod dumbly at the number, my head still spinning with vowels. All foreign students who want to learn Korean in our country have her for a teacher. Wow, I think. Not only is she the best in Korea, she's also the only. On the wall, a long poster illustrates each accomplishment of the Cholima movement. A poster I will study each day on my 15-minute study break while sipping a can of iced coffee purchased from the deserted canteen next to my classroom. "I will learn Korean at Cholima speed," I declare with a smile. Comrade Kim laughs hysterically and then shoots me a somewhat despairing look. The same one younger people will give to their elders when trying their cluelessly and desperately to sound cool. "Nowadays, it's Malima speed," he corrects me. "Did you also study at this university?" I ask him. Kim laughs at the notion condescendingly. "No, I went to the University of Foreign Studies," he replies. That's also where Min and Ro both went, the second most prestigious university in North Korea, besides Kim Il-sung University. "Actually, I studied many different things. At the university, my major was Southeast Asian languages. Thai, Lao, Malay, Vietnamese. But I also studied Chinese and English. Then I did a degree in business." "You must have studied for many years then." "No," he replies modestly. "I actually spent many years working overseas. In Vietnam, mostly. At the Korean embassy. But also as businessman." This dual role might sound improbable coming from any other country in the world. But for North Korea, it is one of the main tasks of its embassies, generating hard currency for the regime. "Oh, and some Italian too, I forgot to mention." Comrade Kim laughs at this for no real reason. I laugh too. It's that kind of infectious laughter. The same laughter I was greeted with at the airport. The laughter that got him through the security barricade and that rescued me and my stack of books. The laughter of someone important enough to relax. To laugh his way through life. Chapter 11. The Mansudae Grand Monument, with its sculptures of the smiling Kims extending across the Taedong River to the Workers' Party Monument, forms one leg of the axis of central Pyongyang. The second axis, also extending from the Mansudae Assembly Hall, stretches from Kim Il-sung Square across the river to the Tower of the Juche Idea. Actually, when seen on a map, the shape formed is less of a dual axis than a half circle, a metaphoric extension of Kim's outstretched arms, embracing the entirety of Chosun. But it is the wide expanse of Kim Il-sung Square that is most recognizable to the outside world. Where military parades, rife with displays of missiles and goose-stepping soldiers that form the mass media's stock footage of North Korea, are held. Standing on the square, you can observe the rows of numbers that have been painted onto the pavement, a testament to the frequent assemblies held here. On the opposite side of the Taedong River, where the axis terminates, is the Tower of the Juche Idea. Kim Jong-il gave it to his father as a 70th birthday gift in 1982. It was constructed at Cholima speed, 35 days. The tower's body consists of 25,550 blocks, one for each day of Kim Il-sung's life up to that point. It is crowned with a cherry red flame that, like the Grand Monument, is kept lit throughout the night, regardless of electricity shortages elsewhere in the capital. When it is open, visitors can take an elevator up for a panoramic view of Pyongyang. Positioned at the top of the steps on the riverbank leading up to the tower, another bronze statue has been installed with three figures representing the worker, the peasant, and the intellectual, a theme that never grows old. The square is dominated by the Grand People's Study House, from whose balcony the country's leaders can be seen monitoring those parades. It is one of two prominent examples of North Korea's unique style of architecture, the other being the Pyongyang Grand Theater, a combination of late Stalinist brutalism and traditional rural Koreana. Both buildings are composed of columnar support structures that fit Soviet architecture's penchant for using neoclassical dynamics to suggest ideals of state power, though they are crowned with the curvaceous flow found in traditional Korean thatched rooftops. Korean head, socialist body. The Grand People's Study House, being the more gargantuan structure, is more eye-catching in its elaborateness, consisting of a whole series of sloping roofs, implying a miniature village in the dashing and elegant syncopation of its 10 stories. It was also unveiled on the great leader's birthday, April 15, 1982, though it could be said that this was his present to the people. Lest they forget, there is a massive granite statue of him to greet them at the entrance. Consisting of 100 rooms and 100,000 square meters, the building was erected at a cost of $1 billion and is the place where Pyongyangites from all walks of life, not just students, come to do research or read. The library is said to contain some 30 million titles across a vast array of subjects, from Western classics by the Greeks up through Shakespeare and the Russian greats of the 19th century, to a multilingual selection of journals recording the latest research in science, mathematics, and technology, plus special rooms dedicated to the works of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, and now Kim Jong-un. When foreigners visit, the librarian is always sure to show off the library's prized copy of Gone with the Wind, one of the few American novels the leadership has deemed worthy for the public to read. Perhaps unsurprising, given the triumphant victory of the righteous North over the oppressive slave states of the South in the American Civil War that forms the novel's backdrop. A favorite in North Korea. I recall my visit here in 2012, when I was introduced to the philosopher in residence, a wizened official in a windowless room, where my guide informed us students can ask questions and he will give the correct answer. Seated before a desk, he shuffled through some yellowing handwritten papers as my group stood before him awkwardly. "Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Philosopher?" the guide asked. "Can you clarify, once and for all, whether the Juche idea had its origins in classical Marxist theory?" I nearly asked. But I choked. To his relief, no one else could think of anything to ask either. On the way out, I'm sure I heard our guide apologize for waking him. The Grand People's Study House is surrounded on either side by the Ministry of Culture and Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Bisecting the square is Sungni, formerly known as Stalin Street. On the other side, two venerable cultural institutions, the Korean Art Gallery and Korean History Museum, face off. After digesting our first day of lessons over lunch, we drop Comrade Kim off at the office and head to the square for a visit to the art gallery. Though, first, I insist on a stop at the Viennese Coffee House behind the History Museum for a much-needed espresso. This was one of the first coffee shops to open in Pyongyang, a joint venture with the Austrian company Helmut Zuckers that opened in 2011. A shot of espresso costs more than an average North Korean's monthly salary, around $3. The coffee shop is empty, save for the barista, an extremely attractive young woman in her early 20s, which fits the profile of every employee I've ever seen at this coffee shop. Men are never employed in the service industry. After we down our coffee, we head outside, where the barista is fawning over two baby squirrels in a small cage she caught on a recent excursion to the mountains. One is running in a miniature wheel that's been constructed out of the remnants of a plastic bottle. The other is munching on a piece of apple. Min squeals with delight and takes out her phone to make a video as the little squirrel runs and the wheel turns round and round and round. Chapter 12. The Korean Art Gallery is home to the largest art collection in the DPRK, consisting mostly of paintings, but also a few sculptural works. Upon arrival, I am instantly recognized by Ms. Kwok Song A, who is waiting outside for us in her trademark pink Chosun Ot, that traditional floor-length Korean dress that looks like it was stitched together from a particularly gaudy silk curtain. In a culture that prizes modesty, it does the trick, completely masking the curves and shape of the wearer's body. I had met Ms. Kwok on my previous visits to the gallery. She's our main tour guide, trained as an art historian. When I asked her about her theoretical work, she informed me that one of her winning contributions to the field, published in the nation's Art History Journal, was a paper on the necessity of having guides in the art museums. Her thesis? The guides must provide people with the correct revolutionary interpretation of each painting, or else they will be lost. The Korean Art Gallery plays host to temporary exhibitions in addition to the revolving display from its permanent collection. Now there are two shows on, both consisting of recent paintings by the country's most prestigious artists. The first, presented in the main reception corridor, features seven large oil paintings by artists from the Mansudae Art Studio, commemorating the recent 7th Workers' Party Congress. Although the rules of the Workers' Party dictate that a Congress be held every 7 years, the previous one took place in 1980, when Kim Il-sung officially announced Kim Jong-il as his successor. This year's Congress saw Kim Jong-un elected as chairman of the Workers' Party, an event that surprised no one. Although the Congress had taken place a couple months before, it still hovers in the air everywhere we go. All of the paintings, Ms. Kwok tells us, have been personally approved by Marshal Kim Jong-un. Four of them are landscapes depicting Mount Paektu in the wintertime. Since most artists working nowadays are too young to have had any direct knowledge of the harsh climate in those environs that Kim Il-sung endured during the years he spent fighting off the Japanese, a group of them were sent there on a field trip in the depths of winter. This punishing experience would supposedly aid the artists in the act of creation. Each was permitted to choose their unique perspective and angle. One, presumably hoping to escape the clichés that have inevitably enveloped this endlessly explored subject, chose to depict the forest surrounding the Holy Mountain, where Kim Il-sung and his comrades hid out. On the opposite wall, the three remaining paintings making up the exhibition would be no anomaly to those familiar with the tropes of socialist realist painting. Workers at happy toil in the factories. Celebrations of quotas being exceeded. The usual inflations of the communist banal. In the hallway leading to the permanent collection, a second series of oil paintings make up the national exhibition, held once a year. Of the 1,000-plus paintings submitted, only around a dozen are selected. The rest of the paintings go into the museum's permanent collection. Among this year's winning works, Girl Mother, a 2016 painting by Ri Yung-un, executed in a colorful, bombastic cartoon realism. A young woman, around 20 years of age, is depicted in traditional university dress in a field, surrounded by laughing children in the red scarves of the young pioneers. She is one of North Korea's latest stars of propaganda, Chang Jong-ae, instantly recognizable. A national hero, the university student was recently given the title Girl Mother by the marshal for her selfless task of raising orphaned children while still practically a child herself. The main collection is arranged chronologically, commencing with reproductions of Goryeo Dynasty-era tomb murals. The reproductions are kept behind glass and appear rather sad, dusty, faded. Most were made during the Korean War in haste, in order to document what very well might have been lost as a result of the destructive bombing by the Americans. One of the highlights features the excavated walls of an imperial tomb outside of modern-day Nampo on the West Coast, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Traditional Korean paintings were done with ink on silk or rice paper. In the 20th century, these classic techniques would morph into one of North Korea's sole indigenous art forms, Chosun-wa. Wa means painting. Chosun, of course, the land of morning calm, the official name of North Korea, how North Koreans refer to all of Korea. With South Korea, Hanguk, as it is called in the South, being referred to as Southern Chosun. In the early days of the Republic, Kim Il-sung would encourage artists and writers to study the works of the Soviet and Chinese socialist realists for inspiration in making their own work. But by 1960, during the so-called Cholima era, Kim Il-sung was preoccupied with the task of separating his nation from the sphere of Soviet and Chinese influence. Through his purges behind the scenes and the promotion of Korean ultranationalism on the forefront. Naturally, the arts, which have always been the central disseminator of propaganda in the DPRK, had to follow. In 1961, at the Fourth Party Congress, strict guidelines were introduced in the cultural realm. Artistic freedom and personal style, as they are venerated in the bourgeois West, were discouraged. Rules for correct form and content, again, Korean mind, socialist body, were brought to the table. The earliest painter to take his cue from the new policy was Kim Young-jun, who is credited as the inventor of Chosun-wa in 1967. True to the new aesthetic doctrine, Chosun-wa used traditional materials, ink, rice paper, and techniques, but its subject matter was contemporary, reflecting the ideals of socialist North Korea. In essence, despite propagandistic claims that this is a pure Korean invention, the roots of Chosun-wa reflect North Korea's specific post-colonial situation. It is a fusion of traditional Japanese Nihonga painting, the dominant form during the years of the occupation, with Soviet socialist realism. Much like the political system itself, that unusual panoply of what came before, Japanese imperialism with its emperor worship, and the Soviet Union of Stalin's era. It seemed to do the trick. Chosun-wa effectively formed the aesthetic foundation of every North Korean fine art form to come. One could never reasonably expect art to be exempt from the monolithic ideological system that Kim Il-sung developed in those post-purge years. But the significant role that the arts would come to play in the promulgation of North Korean domestic propaganda was synonymous with the rise of the man who engineered it, his son, Kim Jong-il. By the end of the 1960s, Kim Il-sung was experiencing further bouts of strife within the upper echelons. It culminated in the 1967 purge of the so-called Kopsan faction, led by Pak Kum-chol. The Kopsan Operations Committee was an underground organization that had provided logistical and intelligence support during the occupation for anti-Japanese guerrilla fighters and, in particular, Kim Il-sung's militia. Pak and his cohorts felt slighted by the rapid expansion of the Kim Il-sung personality cult and the rewriting of history that had completely omitted their own courageous efforts in attributing the liberation of the peninsula to the great leader alone. Suffice it to say that their machinations did not get very far. Pak was soon expelled from the Workers' Party, exiled from Pyongyang, and forced to work in a rural factory, while the rest of his cohorts were arrested and tried on the usual trumped-up conspiratorial charges. Then, in 1968, an armed coup was attempted to remove Kim Il-sung from power. It was masterminded by the Minister of National Security at the time, Kim Obong, who was subsequently purged and replaced by General Choi Yeon. Chong Jing-sung, the pseudonymous writer who would emerge as Kim Jong-il's favorite poet in the 1990s, and later defected to the South, would attribute the genesis of Kim Jong-il's hereditary succession to General Choi. Of course, filial succession was unheard of, taboo in the communist world. Such an idea would have immediately struck the Soviets or Chinese as a remnant of monarchical imperialism. But Choi was deeply conservative, his values ensconced in the traditional Korean Neo-Confucian view that power should be transferred from a father to his eldest son. It was Choi's advocacy that launched Kim Jong-il's rise. while serving to simultaneously distance the DPRK from the main streams of communism in China and the Soviet Union. We can imagine, after all the internal threats and purges of the past two decades, that Kim Il-sung would be easily persuaded by now to keep it in the family. Jong-il, for his part, played his role in the solidifying of the monolithic ideological system when he was elected in 1969 at the age of 27 to join the Organization and Guidance Department, OGD, the most powerful organ in the North Korean government, which has direct access to the leader himself. At the time Kim Jong-il was given his first prominent position, Kim Il-sung's ironclad rule was through the government of the DPRK, which possessed all the ruling powers, not the Workers' Party. The OGD was merely an instrument of the Workers' Party, which was at the time just one of many bureaucratic institutions in the country. In a cunning ploy that would unravel slowly over the course of the next decade, Kim Jong-il would elevate the authority of the OGD by arguing that North Korean society needed the party to play a stronger role in upholding the command and ruling stature of the great leader Kim Il-sung. Eventually, the power to appoint personnel was shifted away from the government and to the OGD, run by Kim Jong-il. Among its activities, the OGD was tasked with carrying out surveillance on all of the great leader's supposed internal enemies. This surveillance became so rampant that it culminated in Kim Il-sung himself essentially falling under surveillance by the OGD. By that point, Kim Jong-il and his cohorts in the OGD had taken over all the prominent positions, transforming the Workers' Party into the most prominent political organ in the DPRK. From 1980, it was no longer Kim Il-sung's government that actually ran things, but the Workers' Party under Kim Jong-il, whose own deification soon commenced. Kim Il-sung was still officially the great leader to North Koreans and the outside world, but in actuality, all of the real power lay with the sun. In this dual structure, Kim Il-sung's men, who were by now of advanced age, were given the most prestigious titles. But that's all they were. Titles. They wielded very little power. The real power was held by men in the OGD. Kim Jong-il's men. This is why there is so much mystique behind the political structure of the Hermit Kingdom. Why so few outsiders are able to understand it. It has its roots in Kim Jong-il's division of powers, which enabled his usurpation of the throne. His pruning would culminate shortly after his father's death in 1994, with the purging of all his father's loyalists, banning them and their progeny from Workers' Party membership, and the banishment of several thousand prominent families from Pyongyang. Clearly, a new sort of loyalty was now required. Walking or driving through the streets of Pyongyang, it quickly becomes apparent that the DPRK has more public art than any other country in the world. In place of the visual pollution of advertising that clutters so many cities in the 21st century, the Pyongyang streets are filled with colorful posters, murals, and mosaics, all made by hand, extolling the virtues of leader, party, country. The art we see and the cultural system attached to it tell us a lot about how the nation functions, how it views itself, and how art serves the ongoing project of engineering the ideal citizen and society. But who makes all this stuff? What is it like to be an artist in North Korea? Certainly the classical model of artists nurturing their private visions solitarily in their studios, churning out works to be sold through the commercial gallery system, does not exist here. The very notion would likely be regarded as classically bourgeois, reactionary, capitalistic. Art, rather, has more utilitarian value than it does in the West and other places. That of propaganda. It is meant to educate, to uphold the system's values, through conveying clear and easily legible messages, not to titillate or provoke contemplation through ambiguity. As Kim Jong-il wrote in one of his numberless treatises on aesthetics, "There is no such thing as pure art disconnected from the lives of the people." If you're lucky, you get discovered early on. Talented children in all of the visual and performing arts are scouted across the country on a yearly basis. The good ones might end up at their local school children's palace, where their talents are nurtured in after-school lessons. The very best are sent to Pyongyang for the country's most rigorous art training. Thanks to Kim Jong-il's obsession.